Given India's track record, how much of this report will have a real impact on the Indian government?
Probably not much, but it does kind of, you know, to use that metaphor, fire a shot across their bows. And it really, I mean, it's embarrassing for them, it's irritating for them, but the accusations made in that U.S. report are entirely accurate, entirely factual. They state and bring, just in black and white terms, things to the fore which all observers of India have been watching with increasing concern over the last couple of years, the last 2 years especially. So in that sense, you know, the Indians may protest too much, but, you know, there's nothing in the report which is actually not accurate, not true. And in that sense, it does kind of, you know, bring to their attention that people are watching and are censorious of the way things are going in India.
What would be the implications of actually being blacklisted by the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom?
As I understand it, if a country is of particular concern, they can impose sanctions on government agencies and officials. I guess people who are identified may be not allowed to travel overseas, may not be able to have bank accounts abroad, you know, all those kinds of things. I mean, you get in trouble with the U.S. and you take on somebody who's kind of hard to avoid. No, here we go, freezing their individual assets. So, you know, that could come quite high up the tree in the BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party government in India, if it's proved that they, for instance, had some direct impact on advising the police in the riots that took place in February not to intervene, not to prevent attacks on Muslims. That could come home very quickly.
Mm. Just in terms of these sanctions, I mean, just how likely do they appear given that the US is, well, an increasingly close ally of India and, well, the direction of the current US president?
I think you've got your finger on it as usual, Sean. Yeah, I think that's really going to be what it is. I think this is more a warning shot, but as you say, Trump, and you remember Trump was in India, he was in Ahmedabad in February and filled up a huge stadium of people, you know, kind of cheering Trump. I mean, it's the biggest crowd that he's probably ever addressed and probably for the next few months that he ever will see. Those, you know, everybody is concerned about China and India is the obvious U.S. ally. And that card is going to trump, so to speak, these minor concerns about violations of human rights in India.
And just sort of looking at the COVID-19 outbreak and the way this might have affected things, by and large, we've seen, pretty small figures in terms of the COVID-19 outbreak in India itself. But has this exacerbated some of those issues we talk about when the finger get pointed at the non-citizens, at the outsiders in these situations?
Much less so than I thought it would do. Part of the reason, one of the things we don't know in India is that the levels of testing aren't very high, and where testing is being done in the better run Indian states, higher levels are being found. COVID seems to be associated with urban density, so of course places like Mumbai, which have, you know, amongst the world's highest levels of human density, have more cases. What's been kind of amazing is that the huge slum areas, Dharavi, which is the world's largest slum, I believe, in Mumbai, although the virus is about, it's not as rampant as one would have thought. These are places where, you know, if eight people are in a room, how do you socially distance, where water is hard to come by, how do you wash your hands frequently? It's, you know, these are places where keeping a distance from other people and keeping clean and so on are really, really difficult. So I think they're doing a reasonably good job, but everybody who watches it is assuming that the numbers of cases are far higher than are showing up officially, simply because the level of testing is probably not catching what's going on. But to your original point, there's been surprisingly little scapegoating. Most of the attention has been on the plight of migrant laborers, who are, on the whole, Hindus, who have been suddenly, you know, as happens to our workers here, you're suddenly without a job, you have no daily income, and so your only thought is, well, let me go home to my village where at least I have family, where at least I have a roof over my head, where at least there's agricultural work to be done and food to be had. And they're the ones who are really receiving the attention. But there's been very little, or relatively little, that I've seen attention on communal aspects of the virus.
Mm. And just as a final point, would this perhaps the warning shot across the bow encourage other allies of India to, well, take at least a little bit of a sideways look at the country's current policies, maybe speak up themselves?
I would hope so. I'm skeptical and doubtful. I don't see our government really taking the same. Oh, we might be doing it in private, but I mean, what's really interesting about this U.S. annual report on religion is it comes out of conservatives, especially out of persecution of Christians, although it's much more open-minded than that. So if we do anything, for instance, in Australia, I'm sure we'll be doing it at a quiet, behind-the-scenes level. So you'd hope so, but I think it's a pinprick as far as the Indians are concerned, Sean.
Well, Peter, do appreciate your time. Thanks very much for joining us, unpacking this one for us.
Always great to be with you, Sean.
Always a pleasure.